sometimes behave so strangely. Hello and welcome to another episode of the So Strangely podcast, a podcast on new research in music science. Today, I'm joined by Brian McPhee, assistant professor of music technology and data science at New York University. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
I pestered you a little bit about all the research that was being showed off at ISMIR this year. What does ISMIR stand for again?
ISMIR is a backronym for the International Society for Music Information Retrieval.
Right. And it just happened like a month ago. So good turnaround time, Brian. And you brought up this article, Vocals in Music Matter, the Relevance of Vocals in the Minds of Listeners. And this was by Andrew Demetrio, Andreas Jansson, Aparna Kumar, and Rachel Bittner. And Andrew is from the Multimedia Computer Group at Deft in the Netherlands. But the crew is also associated with Spotify. And I understand the research was mostly done at Spotify?
Yeah. Yeah, all he right. was embedded there for some amount of time to do this work.
Cool. Well, we'll talk to Andrew a bit more about that. But first, I wanted to get a sense from you how this kind of research fits into the MIR landscape. It started by looking at kind of like tag data, which I think is pretty common in MIR, and then went on to using surveys of users. So was this kind of a typical sort of experiment for MIR, or was it a bit to the side?
No, I think it's very atypical for the sort of thing you see at the ISMIR conference, which I think is why I thought it was interesting, aside from, you know, the content of the article, but the approach is very different. ISMIR covers a wide range of topics around building systems to interact with music, you know, from search and recommendation and performance and all sorts of things. Typically, we, and I include myself in this community, don't deal with direct user data too much because it's kind of hard to get. So as an academic researcher, I don't have thousands of users that I can just go knock on their door and say, hey, would you like to take a survey? So often what we do is try and probe at kind of musically interesting questions by way of implicit data or kind of latent trends that are in observational data. Or maybe we just go off and say like, hey, I think this instrumentation is interesting. Let me see if I can model it. Something like that.
I will say I've seen a lot of MIR papers that also use like Mechanical Turk. So using some kinds of user feedback and maybe perceptual feedback.
Sure. I would just say it's not the majority of what happens in this mirror. Most of what we do does not involve users because it's expensive and it's time consuming and it's hard to do too well.
Well, it's more expensive than free.
Yes.
It's interesting that you bring up the question of expensive, because another thing that I feel like is more common in MIR than other places is for like tech companies and private companies to actually be sharing research at an academic conference like ISMIR. I mean, do you think it's fair to call it an academic conference? Is it an academic conference? Is it like a mixed
convention?
Convention, yeah.
No, I think it's definitely still an academic conference. Basically, the industrial labs, you know, Spotify, Pandora, Deezer, whoever it might be, they're producing scholarly research that is otherwise indistinguishable from what happens in academic institutions, except for what exactly they're publishing on, which tends to involve very large data sets or analysis of user trends that we don't have access to in academia. Right. But otherwise, the type of work and kind of the quality of it is basically the same.
Uh-huh. And is that because it's a lot of academics that end up doing research with these companies and so they take that with them or like?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. This hasn't always been the case, but within the last, I'd say 5 to 6 years, the industrial end of music and particularly streaming services, but you know, other places in the music sector have started hiring people from the MIR community to basically do research to inform their product development.
Yeah.
And that's been really positive for everyone.
Yeah, yeah. And it's really interesting that they bring that knowledge back then to the academic community. My assumption about what a company usually wants is to be more proprietary. And so I find it really cool that there is an opportunity and an interest in doing more back and forth in this area of research.
Yeah, definitely. A part of it comes from recruiting, I would say. Like these companies want to put their research out there so that they can say, hey, look at all the cool things we're doing. Maybe you want to do cool things too. Come and work with us.
Huh.
So that there's certainly that ingredient of it.
Okay, yeah, that's an important piece of the puzzle. Okay, I'm going to try to give an outline of what's going on in this paper. So I read in this paper sort of a three-part process. there's this question of how important are vocals in what people like or dislike in music? And when you're in Spotify, you have a lot of examples of people structuring music and their choices and what music to listen to and all of that stuff. So the first part of the study was to just look at the semantic information around the use of music on this particularly popular platform. So looking at search queries and playlist titles and that sort of thing, to look for information about vocals. And that analysis found that there wasn't a lot of explicit mention of vocals, but things like genre and mood were really popular. And it could be that those, you know, implicitly include vocal characteristics that might be interesting. So they decided to actually ask users themselves. And so from a pool of active users, they reached out and sent surveys to ask them what they noticed in songs and what they liked and disliked in songs. And they asked this question generally and then asked this question specifically about vocals. And what they found is that vocal qualities and lyrics were very common in what people described as what things that they liked and disliked. And out of the responses, because these were text responses, they developed specific categories of qualities that were sort of prominent. And they did a second survey where they asked people to select which of the qualities that came up prominently in this first survey were important to each individual and to rank those that they thought were prominent. And out of that second sort of iteration to really, you know, go through these qualities to get a sense of, well, how important are each of these things? Emotion and mood was highest among the sort of aggregate rank across all of these responses in the second survey, but followed by like a near tie of lyrics and vocals. So if we just look at tags, it's ambiguous as to whether or not vocals are important because it's kind of lost in the details. But when they went on to ask users directly, it was apparent that vocal qualities and lyrics were very important in defining what people liked and disliked in the music that they chose to listen to on this platform. That's a really quick overview. Sorry.
I think you hit all the main points there. The one thing that I would stress is that what's most unusual about this paper in the MIR field is that they started with kind of an observational study. Like, here's a bunch of log data that we have about how people are searching for music, how they're making playlists, how they're using tags. And they could have stopped there and said, oh, we didn't find anything.
Yeah.
But then they actually went and dug deeper and chased down users and said, like, no, like, really tell us what's going on. What do you pay attention to? Mm-hmm. And that's the part that's unique, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And they get at a very different conclusion when looking at it that way. So I really appreciate that subsequent tier of study, shall we say. The things that people valued in terms of like vocal qualities were things like skill and like style matching between, let's say, the vocals and the rest of the music, and also like, you know, cleverness and meaning in lyrics and authenticity. All of these ideas that we kind of can recognize as being valuable in how people talk about music case by case. But to have a large scale study that points to this as being really key is reassuring when all of this information seems to be missing from the, you know, way in which people are trading and structuring the music explicitly on this kind of platform. So that leaves a bit of a question as to, well, why aren't we talking about vocals when we do, let's say, playlists and stuff. But we'll get to that question later.
Yeah.
So is there anything else about this that really struck you as important and interesting?
In MIR, we don't often treat vocals and lyrics as kind of a first-class object in its own right. Mm-hmm. We often think of tasks like separating vocals from a mixed audio recording or trying to predict general tags that might include things describing the vocals, but might also include everything else, instrumentation, style, rhythm, whatever. Mm-hmm. And kind of the starting point from this paper, and they come at it from more of a music cognition psychology background, is that, you know, there's a lot of reason to believe that vocals should be more important, or at least very important. Mm-hmm. And it's worth spending some time to focus on that.
Yeah,
You know, tying from that to lyrics, which are also a huge component in their findings, lyrics are, they're studied in MIR, but not as much as they probably should be.
I mean, they're hard to study. It takes a different skill set. That's always something that I wonder about in MIR is how much of the focus is defined by opportunity.
A lot. so much.
All right. Well, maybe we'll grave about that later. Okay. I think we are about ready to talk to Andrew. Okay.
All right.
And now joining us on the line is Andrew Demetriou. Demetriou, how do you like to pronounce that?
Yeah, I'm flexible. Demetriou is fine.
Andrew Demetriou, who's a PhD student at Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands. So, hey, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Brian and I have been talking about this article, but I was wondering, how did the question of vocals come up? Because, I mean, as we were mentioning before, that hasn't been like a focus of MIR work generally.
Yeah, well, I mean, so the story was I was at Izmir in China at the vegetarian table at the banquet, sitting next to Andres, and just over the course of a number of beers and some conversation, we just started talking about things that we thought would be cool to look at. Mm-hmm. And I actually talked to Andres about this last night, and I told him, you know, I asked him, were you thinking anything at the time, or like, what was your motivation for really getting into this? And he said, well, we had produced a bunch of research already that happened to focus on vocals, and we realized that we didn't have a very specific motivation for it each time. We were just kind of going on this intuition that vocals are really important. Mm-hmm. So he thought, well, it would be kind of interesting if we just looked at it really directly. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was interesting just from a psychology perspective, you know, the vocal communication. You can argue that you know, that's why music exists in the first place. So I always found it a very interesting feature.
Mm-hmm. This all happened at Spotify, right? Mm-hmm. So how did you end up doing this kind of work with them? Were you like doing an internship there? Like, how did that happen?
Yeah, again, it's kind of funny. This was literally just, I met Rachel, one of the co-authors, after a tutorial that I gave, and she and I had an interesting chat. And then I met with Andreas over some beers at the banquet, and we just thought it would be cool to do something. Well, it just so happened that I had a gap in one of my contracts, and I emailed Andreas and I said, hey, you know, can we do something? And I think officially it was a consultancy or something.
Okay.
But they just found some administrative construction to bring me over, and I just hopped over there for a few weeks and did it.
Nice. Nice. Yeah, yeah. Well, you got a lot done in a few weeks.
Yeah, it was fun.
The way it's described in the paper, it starts off with this semantic analysis stuff. Was that stuff that had already happened and then you kind of moved into the survey right away? Or like, how did that piece take place?
I think they had already had a number of ideas of how it is that they might look at this. I think all of them actually had participated in stuff related to vocal source separation and vocal style, like things related to estimating vocal style or vocal activity, like where exactly in the track do the vocals start, that sort of thing. But they were looking for, I guess, some sort of motivation for it. So I think they kind of already had those ideas. I don't remember exactly at what point they executed it, but I think that they were already sort of playing around with this stuff when I came on board.
I would chip in that that's pretty typical of what happens in Izmir. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the researchers in this field are all fans of music, but they're also technically minded. So we try and find ways to take interesting concepts and make them into kind of well-formed quantitative puzzles that we can throw computers at. But we often don't do the hard work of figuring out, is this worth pursuing in the first place until after the fact? In this case, it's great. It worked out nicely. It is worth pursuing. That's not always true.
Okay, so how did this first survey come about? Like, the first question that was asked in survey number one was, what
things about the music do you notice when you listen? We bounced around this question a lot. We tried to think of the single most vague question that we could ask. I don't know if you guys could think of anything more vague, but we wanted to not lead participants whatsoever. Maybe they don't notice the vocals at all. Maybe that's why it doesn't appear in their playlist tags, right? Maybe it's just not something that they really think about.
So how did that turn out? You put out these relatively vague questions. You did structure pretty well, right? You had the first, like, what do you notice in music? And then specifically what people like and dislike. And then you had a second tier, right? Which was, what do you notice about vocals and what do you like and dislike?
We asked them what they might like or dislike to see if the words that they used in the first part, because we let them type in whatever they wanted, right? We wanted to be sure that the words that they used in the first part, that we understood what they were referring to. This turned out to be really good idea, because sometimes people did things like they mentioned the lyrics, but then went on to write a few sentences literally about how the person was using their voice and mentioned nothing about the actual words that were sung. You know,
that
turned out to be really important. And then in the second step, we thought, well, you know, maybe we could still learn something about vocals anyway, in the case that it turns out that they're not important. So we asked the second batch of questions afterwards. Yeah.
Uh-huh. You get a bunch of text responses. Yeah. Yeah. What was your strategy to handle that?
Well, I think what was kind of interesting about this collaboration was we were literally coming from two different ends, like kind of like how Brian said, right? These data scientists and computer scientists that I've interacted with come up with ingenious ways to tackle crazy puzzles. It's really very cool to see. Mm-hmm. But what they thought was interesting was that I was coming from a completely different perspective. Mm-hmm. So I thought they might get a lot out of doing a really sort of basic, super low tech strategy, you know? And I think they were kind of confused or uncertain about the card sorting when I suggested it the first time, like, we're going to do what? And why would we do that sort of thing?
Did you literally like have just a bunch of cards on the ground and you like people just had to walk around and put them places? Like,
yeah. What we did was so in Spotify's offices, they had these huge long tables, right? And mm-hmm. we printed out a bunch of sheets that were the responses. I cut them out into strips. Yeah. And yeah, right in the middle of their offices, we had people walk around and like sort of sort them.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We should take the picture that you have in your slide deck that you had from this and put it as supplementary on this podcast.
Oh, yeah. I could totally send it over.
Please do.
So this was funny because I had done this once before. Twice before, I think, in a couple studies. And you really do learn a lot just by literally sitting and reading all of this text and thinking, how do mm-hmm. I group this?
For sure.
And yeah. I think at first, well, not everybody in my research group was convinced, but I think by the end of it, all of them were saying, wow, we really, really learned a lot about this. So mm-hmm. I thought it was a very nice way to collaborate, you know, to bring two different kinds of techniques together.
That's really cool. I'm glad that they cooperated and tried it out a little bit of the low tech way.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And people who were in the offices around, we're stopping by, hey, what are you guys doing? And we would explain, and they would also get really interested. We had a great time mm-hmm. doing it. Honestly, we spent a full day almost just mm-hmm. looking through everything and discussing everything and thinking about it. It was wonderful. It was a great experience.
When people jump directly to sorting text as if it were tags, or confusing ideas that are maybe expressed in a lot of words for things that might be picked apart in short segments and sequences, that makes me really nervous because there's a huge loss of information in that. And so I really appreciate that these are being read and thought about and then also sorted.
Yeah, this makes me think, like, coming from my own background, which is, you know, computer science, machine learning, statistics, whatever, the first thing that I would think of doing is just like throw this into a clustering algorithm. Uh-huh. And then you bypass all of that. You never even have to look at the data, and you have no idea, did the results that come out make any sense?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So I really like having this like this kind of speed bump in the process that makes you actually mm-hmm. engage with the data before you actually proceed to the next step was really useful.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that got both Andres and I excited during that conversation was this idea that you could sort of merge techniques, right? We're coming from two mm-hmm. ends. But, you know, we are still thinking about a lot of the same problems. And so what happens if we really jam? You know, if I bring in one of my techniques and you bring in one of your techniques, can we create, you know, some sort of hybrid thing that lets us look at these problems from a different perspective? Mm-hmm, and it's mm-hmm. a lot of fun to do. I have to say, watching them do the sorts of things that they do, I thought it was so cool, you know, just seeing how they think about problems, how they tackle problems, how they take things apart, put them back together from a problem solving perspective. I think it's great. Mm-hmm. Let's do some card sorting, Brian. I'm down.
All right. Sign me up.
So through the card sorting, part of what you were looking for was categorization. And I mean, you're basically bumping up on the same problems that people have when they're doing any kind of grouping algorithm, which is mm-hmm. how many groups are you going for? What is, you know, your threshold for things being different or similar? Was there some kind of criteria or a goal that you're using to define what kinds of things come together? Or was it really organic in terms of how the responses separated towards the categories that you ended up using in your second study?
Again, I kind of went kind of old school with this, and I explained it grounded theory approaches to them where you kind of start assuming that you're completely ignorant. And you just, as your study progresses, try and build up knowledge from there. It's not typically applied to card sorting at all, but we started with one card. We talked about it. We went to the second one. We talked about it. And things shifted and changed as we went along. But I do think after a while, if we were to run a clustering algorithm, I think we would get really similar things because we did find a lot of the same wordings and phrases. There wasn't any specific criteria per se. Mm-hmm. We just went through and discussed things and talked about them an awful lot. And so it was a subjective process. We weren't thinking of this as the be all end all answer mm-hmm. to the question, more like a starting point.
The categories that you ended up with were mm-hmm. things like related to emotion and mood, voice, lyrics, beat, rhythm, complexity and structure, musicianship, melody, these sorts of qualities. When you got those categories, did anything surprise you?
I think all of us were expecting specific instruments to be more prominent. I think that was one thing. I remember, maybe it's because I played bass guitar a little bit. I was kind of...
Yeah, it does kind of sound like a musician assumption. Be like, well, obviously.
You know what I mean? Yeah, totally. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
This is my confirmation bias all over the place. But I'm like, what about funky bass lines, yo? I really didn't see a lot of that. So we kind of found that surprising. The way that people described lyrics sometimes, for example, and described vocals. So they would say, you know, oh, yeah, the lyrics are very important to me. And then when we asked what about lyrics might make you like a song, they would say, you know, oh, well, I really don't like it when they're screaming. Yeah. You know, sort of describing the way the singer was using their voice. I realized that this could be a rather difficult task if all you were looking at were the words. And even though we were looking at all this written text, it was still not always quite so clear how to separate things. As part of the magic card sorting, I guess, you really do get into the data and you have to kind of make a bunch of decisions. But there was also a lot that we sort of expected to appear. So a lot of people mentioned the voice, a lot of people mentioned the lyrics. And a lot of people mention how it is that music makes them feel. And I think those things were really not surprising.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm so curious, what kind of information came through as you talked about vocal qualities specifically? What things did they like and dislike about voice in music?
So one thing that came up quite a bit that actually in the rankings I expected to come up higher, although it didn't, was authenticity. Is this person really communicating an emotion or are they faking it? Are they performing or are they genuinely feeling something and expressing it with their voice?
Yeah.
I thought that was really very interesting because, of course, it's based on perception and it's unclear. These are also professional artists who have had an awful lot of practice. So perhaps they could, quote unquote, fake it or perhaps they're really feeling it. A whole bunch of questions sort of come out of that. But yeah, I thought that was really kind of interesting to read into all of their responses about that.
So that, but you thought authenticity would be more prominent?
I thought it would actually be closer to the top. So if, well, I'll tell you my thinking. I don't know if it's completely irrational.
No. Explain, please.
But I was thinking if people think whether or not the music evokes emotions in them is super important and all these sort of unconscious ways that our vocals express emotions could be a part of that, right? Then maybe whether or not I think the person is really feeling the emotion is also really important. And maybe if I think that they're faking it, well, then I have less, I perceive that they're feeling this emotion less. And so it has less of an effect on me.
Authenticity is like a curious one for me, again, because of a musician position, right? A musician worries about authenticity and the lie of performance is a lot more obvious to performers than it is to non-performers, I would think.
You could also look at the flip side of that, which is subdividing this population of listeners into perhaps more cohesive categories based on what they actually listen to.
Yeah.
Right? Because
this
is kind of blind to their specific tastes.
Yeah.
And maybe
if
you drill down to people who stick to one genre, you get a very different signal.
Is that information accessible or was that like separated in the process of doing this survey?
Spotify probably could do that if they wanted.
Mm.
So there are a number of hoops to jump through to get access to anything related to the actual users. So I obviously didn't have any access to any of that.
Yeah.
I do think that somebody on the team probably could do something like that if they wanted. They could jump through the hoops and figure that out. And sort of see, so the people that said lyrical skill is really important to me, for example, maybe they really, really into rap music or something. And that could probably be, analyzed based on their like listening behavior and all that stuff. As the study was structured, we didn't have access to much information about the users at all. We kind of did that on purpose. So we randomly drew, we sent the email out to a random list of 50,000. It was completely random. I think the only criteria was that they were either in the United States or Canada.
This is one of the components of working with a company that actually provides something to its users. Mm-hmm. And working with a user base is the opportunity for connected information that does bring up questions about what is admissible use of data, what kinds of things have people agreed to in their terms of service or not. And I mean, I'm sure that Spotify is very careful about these things, but given you described doing this over the course of just a few weeks, mm-hmm. is there like a review process or something?
Yes.
So how does that work?
This was one of the things that I thought was very cool. So they had an ethics board comprised of some people that were in Spotify and a number of people that were outside of Spotify at universities.
Yeah.
And so there was an ethics review process. We had consent forms that mm-hmm. Were put together based on prior studies that they had done and stuff that I had done. So yeah, we adhered to an appropriate ethics review process that informed participants mm-hmm. of what data it is that we were using, what data it is that could be used, even though we weren't using it in this particular study. They could opt out of stuff at any time, like really an ordinary mm-hmm. sort of consent form procedure. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that was all there. Yeah.
That's
so
cool.
It was, yeah, I thought it was really cool because they sort of collaborate with research institutions and stuff like that on this. Mm-hmm. In this way, at least. I don't know what other research they do. It's a rather large organization, but I had to fill out all the documentation and everything.
Uh-huh. Was it better or worse than doing it at a university?
Yeah, it was the same. You know, it was the same.
Oh, I was hoping there would be like a shortcut.
No. In a way, this is comforting, though. Because,
yeah.
I'm glad that I had to go through this entire process. And
yeah.
It's something that I kind of like because it forces you to think about everything you're going to be doing.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like pre-registering stuff. You have to sit and think, okay, I'm going to do this and then I'm going to do that. And mm-hmm. But yeah, it did happen rather quickly. So we also got lucky with the timing of a lot of things. The ethics board happened to be meeting a short while after I was getting there and all of these things fell into place.
Okay. So. All right. Well, I'm glad that it all worked out. Okay, let's get to survey number two. So out of survey number one, you've got all of these categories. So qualities that people noticed, liked, and disliked about music generally, but then also noticed, liked, and disliked about vocals. And then you did the second survey where you gave them a chance to select categories that were important to them and also rank those categories by prominence or importance. First off, why did you do that? I mean, because you got, for example, like the number of people that mentioned lyrics and the number of people that mentioned emotion in the first study. So what motivated survey two? And how did you decide to process this combined partial rank list stuff? Yeah. So explain.
Okay. So once again, here is the thinking. I was thinking in terms of psychometrics, right? So you want to demonstrate the properties of identity. So are vocals a salient thing in this dimensional space? And are they separate from other similar related constructs, I guess, like lyrics or whatever? Mm-hmm. So I think we were sort of able to demonstrate that in the first study. Mm-hmm. And then we wanted to demonstrate the property of rank. But once again, we didn't really want to lead our participants in any way. So we wanted to present them with a list of semantic categories, components, whatever you want to call them, and give them the option to freely select or not select things. Obviously, this added some complexity to the analysis. Mm-hmm. But once again, we didn't want to lead them at all. So we said, you can pick whichever things it is that you think are important to you. The analysis was challenging. Andreas did it. God bless him for really taking this over because, it was an interesting process. So he did board accounting, but board accounting doesn't have statistical significance tests. To get the p-values that we're accustomed to seeing in scientific papers, he did something called robust ranking aggregation. I think it was developed in fields that do stuff with like gene analyses and stuff like that. And I am not a statistician, so I'm not going to pretend to understand all the ins and outs of it, but it takes lists that are of different lengths and that have different components that are quote unquote noisy in different ways. Mm-hmm. And it sort of normalizes the rankings and then aggregates them. And because the rankings are aggregated, you would expect most of them to be skewed towards zero, right? To not appear on the list, to not be all that important. And it compares this skewed distribution to like a normal bell curve. This is my understanding anyway. And it's a way of testing whether or not the particular item based on relative position And then it tests whether or not that score is different from what you would expect in a collection of randomly ordered lists. In other words, okay. A normal distribution of positions.
Yeah. All right. That makes sense.
It was definitely a complex procedure. And once again, I'm very grateful to Andreas for having taken this on and working it out. But we didn't want to make it simpler because we didn't want to force participants to have to rank the vocals if they did not think they were important, you know?
Yeah.
That was kind of our thinking.
Uh-huh. That's an interesting line to draw.
Yeah, and it also gave us another variable. We ended up not really thinking about it too much or analyzing it too much, but we did have another variable to think about, right? And that's how many mm-hmm. people clicked on the vocals, you know, when they were presented with that list.
Yeah.
And we saw quite a lot of them. I think it was about 72, 73%.
Okay. That was the number that I was wondering about because I didn't see it in your paper. So vocals were very prominent as being at least relevant to this question of liking and disliking. How do the results line up with your expectations? Like for the general list, it starts off with mood and then second is voice and then followed by lyrics and then beat and rhythm and structure and complexity. And while things below that, things like musicianship, melody, sound, specific artists, genre, those didn't get a significant value according to the ranking. So,
yeah, I expected genre to be a little more prominent, to be honest. I know that I tend to favor certain genres a lot more than others.
Mm-hmm.
But it appeared random. I was kind of surprised by that. And voice and lyrics were, if you look at the Borda score, they're really quite close, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Again, I wonder if genre here has to do with the prominence of sort of what kinds of liking and disliking scenarios people come across within Spotify, right?
Because
Spotify is really good at guiding people within genres. So, or sort of, you know, defining their local area of genre. So they're working mostly with music that fit rather than being confronted with music that is different.
Yeah, this is definitely the inherent limitation of having such an encapsulated sample, you know,
mm-hmm.
and it would be very, very cool for me to see a bunch of ranked lists from just different places in the world again. You know, it would be great just to see how somebody from just not from the US and Canada. I can imagine here in the Netherlands, for example, electronic music is really, really very prominent.
Yeah, yeah.
And so maybe for them, vocals and lyrics are such an unimportant thing, whereas mm-hmm. maybe the beat and the rhythm and the melody are so, so much more important to them. It would mm-hmm. be very interesting to see those differences.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I also kind of wonder about the genre effect specifically, right? Like, do you think maybe it's because it's kind of implicit in what people select to listen to in the first place that they don't even think about mm-hmm. genre as being a factor?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Maybe it's like, okay, I really like, say, heavy metal music, but not all heavy metal music. So the fact that it's in that genre doesn't necessarily tell me whether I like it or not.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if that's how people were kind of interpreting that question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like on the Spotify platform, you're searching for stuff and you're picking stuff. And I imagine this, I don't have a great understanding of how it is that music recommendation generally works, but I'm guessing it takes some preferences and compares it to other people who have similar preferences to give you stuff. And so, yeah, I'm sort of already picking stuff that's within a specific genre. So maybe mm-hmm. it's, once again, just not at all on my mind.
The circumstances of when they dislike music maybe matters a lot too. If, for example, your living circumstance puts you in conflict with the people that have different musical tastes, maybe uh-huh. you'd be sensitive to different qualities than if you're mostly in control of your listening experience.
This is why I very much like the idea of collaborations, you know, mm-hmm. Among different kinds of scientists to answer specific questions. Because I'm sure there are ways to examine explicit versus implicit data to come to new understandings about this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
You guys were talking about this earlier, and you've definitely got me thinking about it. So if I had filled out this survey, and then you can check out my listening history, what other sorts of things might we learn? And if there was an appropriate way to do that where we could see, say, for example, the lyrics are super important to me, am I a lot more likely to place more emphasis on what the lyrics are actually saying? Do those things jive with my values? Am I the sort of person that cares about certain, let's just say, topics more than others that are being expressed in the music, you know? And mm-hmm. and does that also then mean that I like rap music more, but maybe certain kinds of rap music more, et cetera, et cetera? There's so much to be learned from this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So the task that you gave people when presented with this list, you said, mm-hmm. please click all the items below that would make you like or dislike a song. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting that it's called a song. I wonder if that's a bias. Was that a topic of discussion? How do you refer to this music? Because there isn't really a good general way of defining units of music. But
if I recall correctly, the discussion was, do we call it a song or a track?
Yeah.
Because I don't think we typically refer to, see, now I'm wondering what it is that I should call it, pop music songs, rap tracks, as pieces.
Yeah.
And so I think for us, the terminology was either songs or tracks. And I think we just went with song, but just because mm-hmm. we thought that might be more part of, you know, typical colloquial usage. But
songs kind of always include voice and lyrics, whereas a lot of pieces don't. Do you know what I mean? Mm. Like if you're looking at classical music pieces or if you're looking at electronic tracks.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned it this way. So I did a bunch of interviews with DJs here in the Netherlands, and they always call them tracks.
Yeah, yeah.
Whether they've come off of a vinyl record or their digital libraries on their computers, they almost always call them tracks.
Yeah.
And when I was growing up, we almost always called them songs, and the albums were almost always called records, at least, you know, with amongst the people that I knew.
Uh-huh.
I could definitely see why it might be a point of discussion, because even defining what a unit of music is an interesting question.
Mm-hmm. That's why I like to call them stimuli. But
one thing that might complicate this further is, and I don't know if this is true of how Spotify structures their database internally, but it's how the Echo Nest did it, which Spotify acquired as part of their audio R&D group. There is a semantic distinction between songs and tracks mm-hmm. in their analysis engine.
Okay.
And you can see this in the million song data set, which they publicly released, right? There's a list of songs and then a list of tracks. And there might be multiple tracks for any particular song. Mm. So the song is kind of the abstract entity.
Uh-huh.
And the tracks would be individual recordings or masterings or releases of a particular song, which gets super confusing when you try and release data and work with it. And yeah, I don't know if that's consistent usage outside of that space, but that might have biased things internally to them. Just throwing that out there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I'm also wondering now, do you think that the average person draws this distinction as well?
I feel I do feel like song is very explicitly something that involves vocals.
I don't necessarily have that connotation, but I might not be representative.
Should we be asking about music preferences? What do you guys listen to? Cool. So,
yeah,
Brian,
yeah.
What kind of music do you typically listen to, if you don't mind my asking?
Oh, boy.
Do you favor certain genres?
Please say nerdcore. Please say nerdcore.
Optimus Rhyme.
Not all nerdcore.
Uh-huh.
I do have a soft spot for MC Frontalot, but...
Of course you do. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. Chiptune, uh-huh. rock, jazz, hip-hop, all sorts of things.
Oh, jazz. That really complicates things.
Certainly does, right? I was wondering if you guys were going to mention this. What about you, Finn?
I'm kind of all over. I range from like early music to electronica to a lot of like contemporary edge music, if that makes sense, you know, and then popular music and hip hop. And I listen to a lot of different stuff.
Do you guys think your constellation of preferences affects the way it is that you perceive units of music?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
This is a question I come across practically myself. Hence, weird neologism like unit of music, which I'm sure no one will agree with later. So,
here's something that I sometimes do, and this is specific to my own work, which is primarily dealing with observational data and existing audio.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Recording.
Yeah.
Right. I don't have to worry about live performances being distinct from other things. It's just like, here's a recording. What do you think?
Oh, that gets really complicated when you add sampling, though, and mixing.
Oh, it sure does.
Oh, I think we've just recreated the problem here.
I honestly think this is one of the things that makes the study of music so very interesting.
Yeah.
We could have conversations like this about every single aspect of every single study, probably, that has ever been conducted mm-hmm. related to things like music preference.
But this gets at some of the challenge that you were facing specifically, because you were trying to generalize over a fairly diverse group. I think you mm-hmm. wouldn't have this problem if you were working within a genre, say, or if you're working within a population with a specific musical shared culture. And so, yeah, there is going to be difficulty there. And there's not a lot you could do about that besides giving people a list. Like, what do you like or dislike about a song slash track slash piece of music, which is kind of unattractive and not recommended in Survey Divine. Yeah.
This is also what makes it interesting to me as a computer scientist is how do you deal with all the kind of fuzzy terminology and disagreements and ambiguities of the data as it comes off the wire, so to speak, and put it into a system that's going to be kind of internally consistent. That to me is where a lot of the fun is.
Yeah, a lot of this, like, how do you tag, how do you label data, right? My understanding is that, you know, a lot of computer scientists are concerned with what their ground truth is, you know, and in at least some instances that I'm familiar with anyway, you know, they collect this ground truth from not expert individuals, but, you know, average individuals looking at stimuli, examining stimuli. And so, yeah, how do you guys do that? How do you judge the quality of their tags? It seems like such a puzzle to me.
I try to define the problem away and not assume ground truth.
Yeah. Well, okay, if you have questions about how the quality of your ground truth sort of stands up, you can sample maybe a percentage or a few examples and at least get a sense of whether the reliability meets your maybe poorly articulated but still informed criteria, right? And I think I've seen people do that, whether or not it gets into the paper. I mean, I think that there is a tradition in MIR to always keep a little skepticism about, you know, what the connection is between these conclusions and what it says about music more generally or data more generally, because it's not boundless. It is limited and it is kind of fuzzy. So, you know, just like in any kind of science experiment, there's a little iffiness in there.
So just to emphasize that point, a lot of MIR problem setups are kind of cast as machine learning problems, right? Consume an audio recording or a user profile or whatever it happens to be, make some prediction, and then compare that single prediction to the ground truth for that item and see, did you get it right or did you get it wrong? Or maybe how correct did you get it if it's something with a bit more structure to it, like say chords? Of course, that assumes a single ground truth. And one of the things that I've been trying to do is push away from that and get multiple points of reference for any particular track. So you can do this with chords or structure analysis or, you know, things of that nature, where you get different annotators to produce reference annotations that you compare to. And now you look at the distribution of agreement between your estimate and the multiple reference annotations. And you can compare that to how the reference annotations agree with each other, which is a much more complicated process, but it does take into account some of the ambiguity that exists in the population of people that would produce this annotation themselves.
At Izmir, you were talking about doing things with rhyme. Are you planning to collect these kinds of annotations for, does this word rhyme with this word, or is this a rhyme here, et cetera, et cetera? Or?
That I don't know yet. So far, I've only done this for music structure analysis and a little bit for chords, although I didn't really talk about doing it for chords. Of course, the problem with that is you have to collect a lot more reference data to do your system evaluation. But you can kind of think of this as being a little bit Bayesian, right? You're marginalizing out over the uncertainty of which annotator did you actually pick to produce your reference annotation. And I think that's a useful way to approach this, because some of that ambiguity is just inherent and you can't avoid it. So you may as well deal with it.
Let's get back to this particular study. Overall, across all of this different work, did you get what you thought would happen in the survey results?
I think based on some of the theoretical papers that we had cited, we did kind of expect the voice and the lyrics to feature prominently. And sort of intuitively, I think this is what we were all thinking when we started the project. We've seen that emotions are important in other research as well. So that also isn't paradigm shifting. You know, they are kind of the sort of things that at least intuitively we thought we would see. It was just kind of fun to see what it would be like if people from different disciplines tried to tackle a single problem and the different ways that they would do that.
I do like that after kind of finding that confusion of having voice not be explicitly available through the semantic information, the direct questions did confirm that lyrics and vocals were actually very important to people. So it's a weird kind of secondary confirmation of expectations, which is sort of reassuring, I guess. You know, if you try harder, maybe you will find what you're looking for. But this process was very legit. I do like the stages of the surveys and stuff. It seems like a good way of getting at these questions.
I really appreciate that. Thank you.
But this does bring up questions of like how they mm-hmm. compare, right? Because you have different sorts of, I guess, quantifications of each of these components. So there's the stuff that came through looking at, let's say, what was mentioned in playlist titles and artist bios. And then there's the, well, what do people bring up when they mention what they like and dislike just about songs generally? And then how do people select from a category? So you have all of these different ways of defining things that are important about music. So mm-hmm. what is there to learn from their conflicts when we try to bring them together?
They are different kinds of data. It's true. So we ended up looking at the ranking because that was actually the question that we had from the beginning. You know, how would this thing rank? Mm-hmm. Rather than looking at how many people had clicked on vocals when they were given the list. But it was something that we were thinking about. You know, why is it that when we just ask people, what sort of things do you notice when you're listening to a song? Maybe only about 30% explicitly mention the vocals, the voice of the singer. But when we give them a list, you know, some 70-something percent of them will click on the voice.
Yeah, yeah.
So the way the information is presented, we can see, is definitely important and something that you should think about if you're going to do this kind of research. We have to interpret the responses differently.
You can't ask all questions of any data set.
No. And what we really wanted from like the beginning of this was, can we establish the property of identity? Can we establish the property of rank relevant to music preference? I mean, that was really the question. Mm-hmm. And so we stuck to that and didn't really interpret anything else. But it definitely left us wondering a lot of things about how it is that we ask questions when we do this kind of research, and what the best way is to ask the questions, what kind of data it is that we should collect the most, and for which specific question. Like all of that stuff kept coming up again and again. It's hard to know.
Yeah. So then, one question that comes out in taking this data and going the other way is this issue of, well, why is vocal qualities, why are vocal characteristics not part of, let's say, search queries or playlist titles, or even more explicit in artist bios? Like, if this is something that's important to people, if this is defining their preferences, why is it missing?
And I think that's a really good question. We do have to consider that, one, the sample was a group of Spotify users, but also that these users were coming from the United States and Canada. Mm-hmm. Perhaps it's the case that vocal music is just very widespread in these areas, and we sort of take it for granted. I think that's one potential explanation.
But that doesn't talk to specific qualities, does it? Is it that the vocal characteristics are just so uniform that it isn't worth mentioning?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was thinking more of whether or not vocals would feature at all. In terms of the way the artists use their voices, I was always concerned that that might get somehow confounded with genre. Mm-hmm. But we see that genre wasn't one of the things that ranked prominently.
But it does rank, genre does rank prominently in the playlist tags and descriptive mm-hmm. search queries. Mm-hmm. So it could be that people are using it as a proxy in that way, but not when answering your survey.
If you have a reason to separate it, then you wouldn't click on both.
Yeah. And I think that the way that people use their voice does sort of closely adhere to genre. I know, especially like in metal music, for example, you have all these, I guess, different subgenres where there's screaming, and then you have the different subgenres where there's like this operatic soaring, mm-hmm. singing sort of thing. And the way that the artist is using their voice does seem to be very closely tied to the genre. So maybe in playlist tags and search queries, it ends up getting confounded in that way. I think that's possible. And that they just simply don't explicitly describe how it is that the artist is using their voice.
You know, even if in their process of like trying to get at these descriptions, I feel like we're struggling to have the words. And I wonder if that's also part of it, is that we don't have an explicit terminology, a shared terminology for describing vocal qualities, vocal behavior. I mean, even just like a really obvious one, like if you're going to describe Adele's vocal style, what words would you use?
Oh, yeah. This is definitely true. I had the opportunity to speak to some people that are experts on how it is that others use their voice, speech pathologists, vocal coaches, this sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
One of which was my cousin. Mm-hmm. So I got to have a great chat with her about how it is that they use terminology, what sort of instruments do they use to measure these sorts of things, et cetera, et cetera. And she said, yeah, it's a really difficult thing particularly if you don't really understand the anatomy of the vocal system. She showed me a little bit of it and explained to me a little bit about how it works. And it really is quite complex. So to start to use terms and phrases that accurately describe the specific behaviors that a person is executing with their voice is really, really challenging without any training.
As far as I understand, even the experts in those fields, you know, like otolaryngologists and whatever, they aren't entirely consistent about the use of terminology either.
That's also true. I don't know how to describe how my favorite singers use their voices. Mm-hmm. I don't know. What does Chris Cornell do? How does he do his thing? I don't know. He sings. I don't have the words really. It's hoarse, perhaps, or
raspy.
I don't know. Raspy.
Yeah.
Raspy, but soaring.
But soaring, truth. Right? You know.
Singers also struggle with a common language here, and it ends up being very genre specific and almost like school specific. And by school, I mean kind of like teacher lineage, you know, who did you talk to about vocal production? And that ends up defining what terminology is used, what concepts people use to control their singing process. And so it is really hard to define like culturally a common set of terminology. There's also an element of frustration that comes into the fact that identity and vocal timbre are really so tightly associated because that's so key to how we recognize each other as individuals. You know, it's creepy when someone has a voice that's similar to, you know, someone you know, right? A lot of stuff is going on in there that we're sensitive to, that we care about, but is not represented in a structure that we have conscious control over. And I wonder if that just has to do with the fact that the information is being processed and is flexible in order to support identification and separation of individuals rather than to support effective categorization at a kind of mechanical level. Well, that was a big tangent. Sorry.
No, but this is a really cool idea, I think, because like we can imagine that there is some universality in the way that we communicate our emotional state with our voice.
Yeah, there's something to that. Yeah, so, for sure.
And so then at the same time, there is some universality probably in how we communicate the emotions that we want to communicate, but then at the same time, a uniqueness that we want to communicate as well. And so how do these two things play together? Because the second one person starts to sound a little bit like another, like when they're doing it on purpose, say, you know, I do an Arnold Schwarzenegger imitation or something. It's funny. It's bizarre. You know, and it's really, I don't know, attention grabbing. Oh, wow, you sound like somebody else.
Yeah, yeah.
I could see exactly why it is that something like this would contribute to the difficulty in being able to have a vocabulary about this sort of thing, because there's so many muscles, so much physiology involved that is so intuitively learned that then figure out how to separate all this out into a collection of techniques, I think is really quite difficult.
Yeah. And I think the perception side is really complicated, as well as the production side. So, So good luck. Well, I mean, I don't know. That's an excuse. We can offer that as an excuse for why people don't bother using this information, no matter how important it is. Given all of that, do you have any follow-up studies in mind for this work?
At the moment, no. So my PhD is tackling sort of different set of questions at the moment. So nothing planned. There are some new avenues of research, I think was the phrase that we used in the paper, that we were really hoping that other people in the scientific community were also thinking about similar questions and pick up or jam with us in a way that we could further our understanding of these things.
All right. I always end up trying to touch on this. It's often really hard to answer this question. But what do you think these results mean for everyday music listening?
The thing that I remember thinking about the most right when we had just seen the results, I remember I was on the subway, I think going back to the apartment that I was staying, and I was thinking, I got emotions at the top, and then I got vocals, and then I got lyrics. And so perhaps there is some relationship between vocals, lyrics, and the emotions. Obviously.
Perhaps.
Maybe.
Right? And you know, as I'm sort of flipping through, you know, the music it is that I was listening to, I found myself thinking, that's interesting. I really love this song. You know, what emotions is it trying to convey? What do the words actually mean? And what relevance do they have in my life? And yeah. I think at the time I had a playlist that was comprised of songs that, like, I spent like a year going back through all of my favorite albums. I spent a whole year listening to nothing but older music.
Yeah.
And this was one of the playlists that was that I was carrying around with me at the time. And I found it to be a very interesting exercise to think, this song really touched me. How old was I? What was I going through? What emotions were being conveyed by the song? And how does that resonate with what was going on in my life at the time? Mm-hmm. And I just found it very interesting to think about. I love this song, right? What is it communicating? How does it connect to me?
Mm. That touches on an active area of research in music cognition, which is looking at explicit associations and life importance, life-based emphasis, basically, on musical pieces that just comes from things being heard and developing associations because of when they are prominent in your life, you know, whether it's a specific event or whether it's happening at a time of your life that's more sort of emotionally intense, like the teenage years are a period at which people form a lot of really strong associations with cultural elements like music. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is really cool that it carries all of this other information. And that's pretty hard to get at, again, with something like this kind of a study, right?
Oh, yeah.
Did people ever mention that in terms of what they liked or disliked? Did they ever say, oh, well, this reminds me, or I don't like, or I do like music that brings me back?
We heard this a lot more so we did some focus groups at the end of it where we heard it a lot more. People referred to certain genres of music. And the way that they referred to it was kind of interesting. They were like, you know, this was real music, man, kind of thing. You know, like this is what this was real creative stuff, you know. And so sort of instinctively, I found myself asking them, OK, well, how old were you when you were listening to this music? And, you know, it ended up being around a specific period. And I totally get it. Like, I'm a big fan of the 90s alternative rock bands and you know, hip hop that came out of that era as well.
Yeah, yeah. Our biases just persist. We can't do anything about them sometimes.
No.
Yeah.
No, I don't think we can.
Sorry, that's a big question for something like Spotify, which is interested in giving people access to new music, is how do you kind of override those biases or work with those biases to still spread someone's interests and give them more or give them new or give them, I'd say more or new is really, really where the challenge is. I won't say better, that might offend people. So,
taste expansion. I had an interesting exchange with my supervisor, who is, you know, she's a classically trained pianist, and mm-hmm. I of course know almost nothing about classical music, barely anything at all. And she and I were exchanging songs for quite a while. I would give her a piece and she would give me a piece and I would give her a piece and she would give me a piece. And a big question that emerged from this conversation was, you know, so what sorts of things determine whether or not I liked a particular track? Yeah. And I mean, I don't think we know at all, but we did talk about things like complexity. Mm-hmm. I sent her an Opeth album. I don't know if you know this band, Opeth. And I had sent her, you know, some Nine Inch Nails stuff. I actually took her with me to a Nine Inch Nails concert. That was a lot of fun, her first rock show.
Oh, nice.
But
nice.
There were definitely like compositional elements, I would say, to describe it vaguely, that uh-huh. she found really quite interesting. And the more sort of recursive compositional styles were less interesting to her.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And when she sent me music, she said it was things that had weirder time signatures, that were more experimental that I found interesting, and she found this to be a significant thing. So
yeah,
I'm not sure, but I imagine somewhere in there, I still look for new music all the time. I'm sure there's a way to tap into what it is that I'm looking for. I don't know what that is yet, but
I have so many ideas about that, but I think we are out of time. So we're going to have to cut it off there. Thank you so much, Andrew, for coming on and sharing all of this with us. This is really, really interesting, and good luck with your PhD.
Thank you so, so much for inviting me on. Really, it's been nothing but a pleasure to chat with both of you. Bye-bye.
All right. Wow, that was a really fun conversation. I feel like we went pretty far afield.
I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, but there were some really big ideas that we got to get into. So this, I guess, is the final test for you, Brian, as the recommender. Can you give us like a quick summary of what the paper's about now that you've heard all the in-between and background?
Oh no, am I going to be graded on this?
I might include a scoring in the show notes.
Yeah. Oh, great.
No.
11 thumbs up. So this paper was basically trying to get at the question of how music listeners, particularly on Spotify, perceive the importance of vocals in determining their preferences and tastes. As we discussed throughout the podcast, the initial study was taking observational data of how people search and organize playlists and how they tag them, and didn't find much on the surface level that indicated vocals as having priority over anything else. Mm-hmm. And then they went and dug a little deeper, conducted some user studies, and had people actually tell them what they thought was important and what was not important. And it turned out that the big indicators were vocals, lyrics, emotion, and beats and rhythm, but that didn't really come up in the conversation. But that was definitely in there.
Right. That's a very succinct summary, Brian. Super.
I like the one sentence abstract. What can
I
say?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Wow, we need more of those in the world. Okay. I have to say, I didn't really think about this reading the paper, but as we were discussing what they meant by a song, I'm now really wondering about those numbers of like how prominent voice and lyrics is when people are talking specifically about songs versus music generally. And I don't know, how do you feel about that?
I feel okay with it. I think as music researchers, we're a lot more sensitive to these distinctions than probably the general public would be.
Yeah.
It's sometimes important to remember that kind of framing. Mm-hmm. But also, like, the study was constructed in such a way as to not bias things too much upfront towards being about vocals. It was like, what factors are important? And does the actual phrasing of the first question?
The first question is about music. And in that case, lyrics came up about half the time and vocals came up a little less than a third of the time. Yeah,
I whipped out De Morgan's Law and cranked out the numbers of what the total responses are for vocals or lyrics, and it's about 70%.
Okay.
So I think that's a pretty strong indicator.
Uh-huh.
And it's you should expect that, right? Like, at least for this kind of population.
Yeah, given this population. I think that's an important one.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. We talked about convenient sampling in the beginning, right? Like, this is still a convenient sample. It's just a slightly less convenient sample. It's who can you get access to through Spotify's user base.
And which is engaged, active population, right? These are people that are exerting preference on this platform. And so these are questions that are on their minds. Yeah.
And the authors of the study are very upfront about like, hey, this is conditional on this particular population. So everything is above board there.
Yeah. Yeah. And it does add to their starting point, which was, vocals don't come up much in how people are using words about music. So what's going on here? You know, it is a good counterpoint to that initial finding of an absence of explicit mention.
And actually, one of the things that I'd been thinking about during our conversation, but didn't get a chance to dig deeper into, is how much of this effect that we see in the first study, where it was just the observational data.
Yeah.
And we see that genre is like the most important thing for playlist tags and search queries. Mm-hmm. I wonder how much of that is just inertia based on how music streaming services and previous to that record stores were organized. Like, we're used to looking for music by genre because when you walked into the record store, that's how it was done.
Yeah.
And streaming services kind of emulate that, although it's
kind
of drifted from that. But then the flip side of that is how much of genre actually is determined by vocal style, right?
And
it's not for every genre, but for certain genres, it's very important. It would be interesting to dig more into that.
I guess I would say it kind of goes two ways, right? There's vocal performance differences between genres in terms of what is typical. But then there's also vocal differences of artists within genres that can be very prominent and important to people's preferences.
Or even within the same group, right?
Yeah. And that feeds into artist preferences, which are the next stage, right? In a record store, it's genres and then it's artist. And it gets a bit more complicated when we're talking about, like, let's say music played by DJs, either, you know, in venues or on the radio or that sort of stuff. That comes closer to a question of matching style. But that initial categorization that you get from the record store has that clear hierarchy of those are your two options of identifiers that people are working with until you actually start just talking about the music directly. Wow. So this brought up a lot of really important questions, both about how to do research and along with these results themselves. And I'm really glad you recommended this, because I think this question of, well, what is in the tags? What is in the information that's already accessible? And then what information might be closer to our questions, and finding an alternative route to that that might challenge, you know, what is absent or what is present with an initial explicit semantic categorization.
Yeah, and it just gives me lots to think about in terms of someone who deals with audio signals and statistics. How can we start to try and capture some of these different vocal qualities and different things that actually do matter that aren't explicitly mentioned in tags? How can we kind of surface that information and make it more directly usable? That's the sort of thing that excites me.
In the qualities that they talked about, the information that they got from users on what matters to them for vocals, there are some specific things that then came up in the rankings as being important. And I wonder if you have any ideas as to how that might be captured directly. So, for example, singing skill was top the list as being things that were important for what people liked and disliked for vocal qualities or characteristics. The next one was how well the voice fits or matches the rest of the music. I think a really interesting and hard one.
that's real nebulous, right? And they mentioned this in the conclusion. This can mean a lot of different things. We're not really sure.
I guess my first assumption there is that it would be a matter of whether the vocal style of this particular track is consistent or contrasting with genre norms. That's sort of the simpler thing. And that would be, I mean, accessible through certain kinds of data if you had a good way of capturing vocal characteristics generally and could run statistics on that across a genre. The meaning of the words was up there. Cleverness of lyrics is up there. And that's sort of stuff that, you know, people are doing with natural language processing a bit. So maybe. And then authenticity was on that list as well. And
I have no idea how to approach that. That one scares me.
What do we use to judge authenticity? A lot of sort of metatextual information. And maybe there are qualities, you know, that define cues that someone reads culturally as authentic or inauthentic.
Yeah, or it might, like, if you take a genre like punk, it might anti-correlate with singing skill, right? The singer's too good. That's not real. Could also be aspects like, is this auto-tuned? Like, is it set to a click track? Things like that. And those you could actually get at quantitatively without too much work.
Uniqueness.
That one is fascinating.
Yeah. I really liked how that was in that list of important. And, unique is so subjective.
Yeah. By definition, it's relative to some background distribution or background knowledge.
Yeah.
Unless it really is just a universal outlier and doesn't look anything like anything else. But I doubt there's too much of that around.
Of course, like things like cleverness of lyrics, like that is also something that is pretty relative. I've read write-ups of people talking about their favorite artists, and often they're really enthusiastic about how clever the lyrics is. And I read the lyrics and I'm like, really? And that has to do with how I'm judging what they're doing compared to what I might expect otherwise. And, you know, this is again a totally subjective judgment, so maybe I might be more harsh or not understand whatever's there properly. Like, that totally could be my bad in misreading the quality, but all of that stuff informs whether or not I believe that the lyrics are good, you know? So I don't know. I think this comes up every time we have a conversation, Brian. I'm like, subjectiveness is everything. And it's not like you disagree, but it doesn't help you at all.
It's like, no, I just take subjectivity into account in that statement as well.
Fair, Brian, fair. Is there anything else that really struck you that came out of our conversation?
Yeah, I don't know. It's just got me thinking about how I can use some of this information to inform the sorts of problems that I'm interested in and pull some of these things out of music recordings. Like, it seems pretty clear that we should be trying to do some of this, and a lot of it I have no idea how to do, and that's cool.
Yeah, it's a challenge. It's an opportunity.
Research.
One thing that I didn't want to ask because I felt like that might be putting Andrew on the spot is if there's a way for other people to look at the responses that they got, particularly the first question that they had about, you know, what in music do people notice and what informs likes and dislikes. There's a lot of stuff other than vocals and lyrics that is going to be in those results. I hope that Spotify follows up and uses that information for more kinds of investigations, because I'm sure that is such a rich collection of responses. Like, I want to know what's on those cards. I hope more comes out of that.
The thing with that, though, is like they, at the end of the day, had a relatively small sample of users that they got. So they sent out 50,000 requests. They got about, what, 800 responses, 900 responses?
Mm-hmm.
And from those, like 600 and some odd actually finished the study.
Yeah, that's still a lot of responses.
Oh, yeah, that's a lot of responses. So that's a lot of explicit feedback.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
People telling you what they think.
Yeah.
The question is, how? What is, say, the information rate of that relative to all of the implicit feedback that Spotify gets every second based on what people are actually doing?
Well, I think that should be placed against each other, right? Because there's something...
Exactly.
Or what I would hope Spotify would consider doing with this is comparing what they might otherwise know about preferences against what people say. Because I think that would be really interesting. Although knowing what people like based off of what they do is, again, a little complicated. But
absolutely.
Yeah.
At some point, though, there is a trade-off between small amount of very deep data and a very large amount of relatively shallow data.
I can't believe you think that hundreds of responses is small. I just
I'm saying relatively small. This is only relative to what they have access to implicitly.
But sure. But it's a lot richer.
Like we kind of danced around earlier, like
yeah.
It would be great to try to slice this down to smaller populations that are more specifically guided. Once you start doing that, the more you slice and dice your data, the smaller those sets get very quickly.
For sure.
And I respect that they didn't try to do too much with this data, right? They have one question they tested at, and that was good. And I think if they wanted to do more, it would be better to collect, like do more data collection that was targeted for a follow-up question.
What I'm thinking is here isn't necessarily complete answers or publishable answers, but mm-hmm. an opportunity to find new starting points and new maybe definitions to use, terminology to use in subsequent questions. So I would see this as a really useful thing to play around with and explore in order to inform further studies. I just be clear here. I'm not advocating for, you know, excessive use of a small data set, even though this isn't small.
No.
Basically, I wish the section on that first survey was maybe like three times as long, because I feel like there would be a lot more that they could have shared, because I have so many questions.
Yeah.
And I'm all the way over here on the other side of the paper. So anyway, we missed the opportunity to grill Andrew on that. But if Spotify ever feels generous, I hopefully they're looking for more researchers to work with this kind of stuff again. So yeah. All right. Well, Brian, any final thoughts?
Vocals, I'm convinced, but vocals are important.
Good. I'm glad. I'm glad that came through, that this was a convincing piece of evidence. Did you think that vocals weren't important or less important? Like, was that a change of position for you?
No. Well, okay. So like Andrew was saying, it's very dependent on what genres people are into in the first place.
I mean, important for you as an MIR researcher.
So from that perspective, I think everyone agrees that vocals are important, but there hasn't been much quantitative work outside of a few kind of targeted problems like vocal source separation or vocal melody extraction
mm-hmm.
that really digs into that and what it means for search and recommendation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this paper does a great job of showing just how much there is to gain if we really get a handle on some of these different aspects of vocals.
Mm-hmm.
So that to me was surprising.
Cool. I'm happy to hear that it's something that can motivate a focus. That'd be really cool if that's
definitely
what happens. All right. Well, Brian, thank you so much for recommending this paper. This has been really fun. And thank you for coming on the show. I've been meaning to have you on. So
I'm glad we can make it happen. This is a lot of fun.
And that's it for this episode of the So Strangely podcast on recent research in music science. If you want to get in touch, you can follow the podcast on Twitter at So Strangely Pod. You can find us on Facebook as the So Strangely podcast. And of course, check out the website and blog at sostrangely.com, where we keep all of our show notes. And if you are a music science academic with your hands on a new publication you think people should hear about, get in touch. We would be happy to make that happen. So drop us a line through the contact form at sostrangely.com/contact or email me directly, Finn@sostrangely.com. And if you liked what you heard, recommend us to friends, colleagues, students. We're always hoping to expand our audience and find new people to participate and share recommendations from their specific area of music science. Thank you for listening. And until next time, keep digging into the how and why music sometimes behaves so strangely.
Sometimes behaves so strangely. Sometimes behaves so strangely. So strangely. So strangely. So strangely. So strangely. So strangely.